Hello, heroes, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host, Alex Roberts. Heroes, I'd like to start this episode by just saying thank you. Thank you to everyone who I met at Gen Con and spoke with and shook hands with and hugged and got very excited about. I had a wonderful con, and a lot of that was thanks to the support and friendliness and interesting conversations that I had with some of you. Really, just thank you so much. And especially thank you to everyone who came out to the One-Shot fan panel and hangout on Saturday night. The hangout was so much fun, ridiculous amounts of fun. And the panel turned out great. I'm really excited for that to go up on the main One-Shot feed very soon, so everyone will get to enjoy it. I debrief pretty extensively about my Gen Con experience on the next episode of Second Watch, which should be up this month. So for now, I'll just say thank you. Thank you for your support. Thank you for your kindness. Thank you for listening. My guest this episode is Gabriel de Los Angeles, who is doing graduate work in learning science at the University of Washington and uses LARP in education and outreach with urban indigenous youth. He's a brilliant guy doing some fascinating work. So let's jump right in. Recording has been hit. Now, yeah. Start again with the workshop with kids integrating robotics and storytelling.
I'm working with Dr. Megan Bang, Dr. Carrie Zhou, Dr. Philip Bell, I'm just a research assistant on their NSF grant that ties together Seattle Public Library System, University of Washington, University of Washington Bothell, and the Pacific Science Center all together as a huge collaboration over the next 4 years to develop a set of workshops that for these backpacks full of boards and parts. And basically right now we're only working through this thing called Hummingbird Duo, which is this like Raspberry Pi like tiny motherboard that you can plug all sorts of motors and lights and sensors into. And right now that project is going into has been piloted out with other organizations locally like Red Eagle Soaring and things and Compass to work with populations to develop these backpacks that are going to eventually be placed into library systems that people can check out and do robotics and computing at home. And the goal is to integrate robotics and storytelling so that to push further and further into the ideas around STEAM. And so a lot of people are bandying about the term STEM all over the place, right? So science, technology, engineering, mathematics. But there's been a move that followed up on that to make sure that the concept of art science is developed in a particular framework so that we have an understanding that one, science, engineering, and all these other Western scientific practices aren't taught inside of a vacuum, so that for one thing, and then for another, when we relate these things through art and through tinkering and play and making, then we get all of this work that puts culture back into the space of what we tend to have been pushed into thinking that is a cultureless space. It's like the idea that the singularity, the whole idea of the robotic singularity that we're eventually going to be one and man and machine are going to be one, and then there's going to be no culture involved in there. Like it's just like some sort of sterile space that's just suddenly we're going to shove chips into our head and suddenly everything's more awesome. Anyway, that's a total aside. The fact is that I'm working on this project that's going to be going on for the next few years. We're looking to expanding some of our sites. We just ran through two sites with Red Eagle Soaring and Compass, and then we're going to be doing some work with the Pacific Science Center and launching of the site over there. These are going to be like 4-week programs where families, and the goal is to make sure that we're working with families and that families themselves are working within the structure to make essentially dioramas of their own personal stories. And I got to see some of the most beautiful pieces of work that were with these indigenous families at one site. One of the stories was that of this moving diorama that they have made was about their an adopted family's adoptions all collated into one story. So the so these families are wanting to tell their own personal stories in these community venues, in these spaces, and with this new technology in ways that helps them innovate their own ways to tell their own stories. And I'm just so excited by it. It was super cool seeing all these kids from like 6 all the way to 14 working through robotics in ways that they had never had before, and then their parents getting super excited for doing these kinds of things. Like there were these really great immigrant families who were putting together some of their own personal stories in these spaces too, and it's just neat seeing them get these kids and the parents get super excited over how can we do this? Well, you know, and then seeing what other people are putting together helps them move their own stories and development along in various ways. It's hard to describe without seeing the boxes that were being made. But they're like, I don't know, there's a lot to it. That's just one thing. That's just one thing that's going on. That was my summer, or part of my summer.
That's just one amazing project that you're working on. I want to ask you a little bit more about that, but you mentioned working with a group called Compass and a group called Red Eagle Soaring.
Yeah.
What are they about? What are those organizations?
I can't tell you a whole heck of a lot about Compass. There are not because I'm for any reasons, but other than I don't know. I only got to be with Compass a little bit, and it seems to be an organization that works with families in various ways, which is really neat. But Red Eagle Soaring, I can tell you all day about, which is a Seattle Indigenous Young People Theater group, essentially, that it's for Indigenous kids across the greater Seattle metropolitan area and then some, who come together at annual events or events that are held year round. And then there is a summertime 2-week event going on right now called CAP, where they make a play and then put it on over at the EMP in the Sky Church over there. They've told stories like local, they take local Indigenous stories like Salmon Boy, like Moon the Transformer, and turn them into contemporary or pieces that are mostly improv. It's really neat. They work with Indigenous storytellers. They do all the directing themselves. They work with other with professionals on developing these stories. There's even some of these pieces have become musicals in their own right. So like a lot of that work, getting to have to been joyfully exposed and get to take part of that that space with them. We invited Red Eagle Soaring to be a part of this other project of telling stories with robotics, and that's where that's gone.
No, that sounds really amazing. You know, you talk about being able to tell their stories and being able to tell their stories together and to each other. What does that mean to you? What is the value or what comes out when people are able to tell their own stories of their lives?
Well, storytelling in and of itself as an Indigenous person, for me as a member of the Snoqualmie tribe, in my bachelor's days was my English lit major. So stories and storytelling have always been a deep part of not only my cultural practice, but a part of the things that I'm a big fan of. The various types of stories that many different cultures have told in many different ways. So it's like very similar stories and sometimes often very plagiarized stories that turned into various different things at different times in history. So for myself, getting to love the fact that I'm seeing one Indigenous stories being told in these ways locally on a more community level, on a more regular everyday level than I have ever gotten to interact with in my entire life. Because as an Indigenous person, my nation, my people's stories aren't told. It's not a thing that hits either the Pacific Northwest, which I reside in, or the just education in general. That is coming to change in the near future, with all sorts of the since time immemorial teaching certificate, as well as Washington State starting to require more Indigenous history being taught within Washington State schools, which is great. Mm-hmm. All told, this starts to give myself and then the people that I get to work with more room to talk about storytelling as the place to come together. For Roger Fernandez, who's a fantastic storyteller out here with the Sklallam people, he often tells stories his shtick on it is that storytelling is teaching, and that's well and true for a great deal of cultures around the world and locally about the idea that storytelling is supposed to encapsulate a number of lessons that as you hear a story multiple times that you're going to parse out different lessons that come out of it. And for me, why storytelling it becomes important like that, that means that if I take that practice not just to my own culture, and I take that practice out as an English lit major, out to other cultures, the more times that I hear a story, the more times I encounter different versions of that story, the more times I see so much more being developed. Like, if I fall in love with a series, like I fell head over heels in love with the Dresden Files some time ago, and I read the shit out of it. Every time that a new book was coming out, I had to reread the whole series over and over again. And then for some reason, I would pick up on so much more about Harry or so much more about of the world of thinking about magic in the way that Jim Butcher ever put out that way. So for me, storytelling is the center of everything that we do as communities, and thinking in a very anthropocentric way, that the whole idea of that just people come together to tell stories about one another, and whether or not you're sharing your stories across 140 characters, or you're spending all of November doing NaNoWriMo, or you're doing game development. Game development to me is a huge space for storytelling and integration of people's stories, whether or not they intend for it to be that. Well, so like when researcher me gets to sit down and take a look at how games are going and sit there and talk to the plot team members or whatever and see from a more bird's eye view of how information is moving around at games, I just can't help but see like little clouds and bubbles of cultures and history in the body of one person mishmashing with another person and then seeing what comes up out of an interaction. And for me, that's just the highlight of it, just to see how culture moves around so dynamically within one human body meeting another human body or another group of human bodies, and then suddenly something beautifully explosive comes out of somebody's experiences, and then they have to write a blog about it and tell everybody about it, and then tell everybody, well, you kind of had to be there to really understand what I went through. But yeah, I love storytelling. It's at the center of it all.
You're really making me think of, after every big convention, you see, especially, you know, all over Facebook and Google Plus and whatever, people do these wrap-up posts.
Oh, yeah.
And people have a really, really strong need to do that. And to, you know, cons can be really like emotionally intense and like they're very like interpersonal experiences. And they can be very powerful and meaningful experiences for people. And people have this incredibly strong need to encapsulate that experience, mm-hmm. even though you can't, and you can never explain it to someone who wasn't there, but they're like, I need to narrativize this. Speaking of cons and of bringing people together, mm-hmm. You were involved in organizing SakuraCon, right, for many years?
Yeah, me and somebody I was dating at the time, we went to a convention by the name of BakaCon in 1999, and we found out that they were having a staff meeting soon after the end of the convention. We're like, yeah, why not? This seemed pretty cool. So it was my very first anime convention. And I'm like, oh, all of these, this 200, 300 people here, this is really intense. Everybody loves everybody. And they had like all this really cool art stuff going on, this art show, people putting on all these amazing costumes, which really weren't all that great back in the year 2000. But like, you know, this burgeoning anime field where we were trading back, I'm going to start showing my age now, but where we were trading back and forth videotapes with like fourth generation copies. Oh, I love my fan subs. I still have trunks full of fan subs.
Oh, it's an incredible culture. Like, I am so fascinated by all that stuff. Like, being an anime person in the 90s was such like a strange, like all these bizarre rituals and like these objects of incredible value that were so hard to find that you would just like keep forever. You'd watch like two episodes of a 100-episode series and be be like, I'll never find the rest, but I love these two episodes on, on this bootleg VHS.
and it's changed so much, but it was so, not like in a horrible way, it's just a really wacky, different way that the culture of distribution has shifted so dramatically with digital spaces. But like, on the idea, so yeah, once upon a time I used to be a member of before BakaCon and now SakuraCon, where we built it up into and wrote all of the nonprofit code and all these policies and procedures, and we got all the handshaky goodness with all these companies that, well, no longer exist. and like, so it was really, really an intense point of my life, to basically from like 99 to 2007, where I was getting to observe, not even knowing that I was just observing and learning about these things that not just at SakuraCon, but like all the science fiction fantasy conventions, all the comic book conventions, they have this, they have some really great stuff that they were, the people come together, hold an event, and then before there was digital space for us to disperse all this information about, we would just hang out and talk about it, and then these stories would get passed on, and then such word of mouth would spread the word of the convention around and around in local communities, and sometimes there would be like these stories would get so awesome, the press releases and all these other spaces would suddenly get picked up, or maybe we got into be in the local news, or things like that, where it, like, I remember we were on KCTS9 doing phone funding. It was our PBS station, and we were doing phone funding calls for telethons as an organization to try to get people to be like, oh, that's cool. Look at all these strange looking geeks with all their fancy clothing on there. And I dressed up in my finest suit at the time. And we got up there and had a short interview. But most of the time we were on the phones listening to a lot of people tell us that they liked the Red Dwarf telethon that we were on or whatever. And trying to, I mean, back in the day when you were trying to get your voice of your convention out. And we did it so successfully that we had like a 40% growth rate between each year. It was super intense. Those are really, really great times. And watching like all these companies like Bandai and Pioneer and then eventually Pioneer be turned into Genion, but like there's so many other companies that grew up to be great powerhouses or branched off from the Japanese headquarters and to be great powerhouses for like the next 5 years. And then the plateau hit somewhere in there. I have a whole lot of think about anime as a culture and a group of people, of who practice it and the people who love it. And having at some point that followed afterwards, I actually ended up in a job that took me around the world, that I ended up seeing a great deal of the kinds of comic book and anime conventions all the way in Scandinavia, all the way out to back to Japan and things like that. So, I mean, there's a lot. I've seen a lot of stuff.
That's really interesting, actually, because I wonder, something about con culture that I feel is probably really similar, whether it's like a comic thing or a game thing or an anime thing or whatever. I feel like there's probably a lot of cultural similarities there and things that get transferred over. And there's a lot of people who go to many different kinds of cons. But I wonder about what they're like internationally and like what, you know, is a Danish anime con different than an American anime con? And you're looking like maybe the answer might be a little bit yes.
they can be different, yes. I've been on multiple sides of the convention ecosystem, if you will. I've been the attendee, I've been the low level staffer, I've been the high level staffer, I've been the board member, I've also been a vendor, and having gotten to see internationally the perspective of conventions from the view of a vendor, somebody who was selling comic books and things like that, there was some point in my life where I was like, wow, that Naruto fan person was the same Naruto fan person that I met in Hawaii as it was in Sweden, as it was in Germany. And obviously I'm not talking about the same person, but like,
but, yeah,
their excitement was the same. They were always like, Naru Sasu's not the pairing I'm looking for. I'm looking for Sasuke and Naruto, because Sasuke is always going to be the one who's going to be in control of this relationship. And like all these kinds of like debates about werewolves and vampires, pirates and ninjas, and all these things were all like the small world of internet global memes starting to take off in so many different ways and affecting these international level communities in so many different fun ways to watch. You know, I didn't even think that I was just selling anything at that time. Getting to see and hang out with all these people who just genuinely loved life and loved a hobby was really cool. And that, yeah. I guess that was always my love of it, was just seeing communities of people get together and hang out, so that at some point when I stepped away from that kind of life and that kind of work, and when my best friend and brother Ron Leota, who's a host of the Northwest Nerdcast out here in the Pacific Northwest, he told me about LARP for a long time, and I never got into it because I was always flying around the world selling these comic books. But then when I was done with that, I'm like, I'll try this LARP thing. And then I found it. I found my most favoritest way to explore role playing that I had ever found in my entire life. And I've been a role play gamer since I was like 12, 13. My best friend took me to the local comic book shop and gaming shop at the time called Games Plus, where we sat like right next to a round table pizza and got super duper, you know, fat on pizzas and Mountain Dew and you know, the birth of alpha and beta magic cards and all this funny stuff. And since, you know, that was all out here, getting into that. And then like, I never thought that games could ever be like this, where you get up and start living these lives out in ways that the sheet of paper and the dice could never convey. And so for so many of the role-playing games, the events that I've only gotten to play weekend-long games, I've mainly gotten to play weekend-long games. I've gotten a handful of like one-shot, few-hour type games. But so for me, these weekend-long gatherings were where it was at, because it was like a convention in the woods. And then afterwards, everybody would go to, you know, an afters or an after party or whatever anyone wanted to call it. And we would just sit and talk about all of our stories, just like it was a convention. Yeah. And so I loved every piece of community that went into any one of these organizations that I've gotten to play in over my life, because it inevitably boils down to the storytelling that we get to do as a group of people, whether or not like that AMV contest was super amazing, or did you get to check out that full body mecha suit that somebody was wearing, or that great piece of armor and garb that they were wearing while they were in the middle of 80 degree weather and fighting a crate fight against a giant dragon, which was an amazing prop, and yada yada yada.
Yeah, the stories that come out of those kinds of long events. I went to Magiscola a couple weeks, not last weekend, weekend before.
Super jealous.
Oh my gosh. It was my first experience of like a weekend long LARP like that. Like, I've only ever done the really short things. And I can't believe how much happens that you only see the tail end of, or you never really hear about. And then weeks later, you're like, you guys were doing what on the other side of the... over there, you know, or you're like, oh, that I talked to this lady who was all upset because her boyfriend had been turned into a vampire. She wasn't sure if it was going to work out between them. And I was like dealing with that angle. And then 2 days later, I talked to the guy who was the vampire who turned her boyfriend. I get to hear the story of how that went down and everything.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, like it's information is so distributed, and it is very much like a con where you really have this need to debrief and talk about it. And yet the stories that come out are so different.
I wonder about, like, I guess societally speaking, research speaking, suddenly something pops into my mind about FOMO, that whole thing about the fear of missing out. And I wonder how deeply that does or doesn't affect LARPers in the same way, because of the fact that there's assumed you're going to miss out on so much going on. You can't, because you don't have the power level, or you don't have the gear, or you're not in with that crowd, or you're just getting into the new story or whatever, you know, just the whole idea that even if it's a one shot, there's just stuff happening around you that you don't get to participate in. Mm-hmm. And that's just a fact. And so what do these practices inevitably teach, getting back to even some of my own thinking, get back to teach about not only storytelling, but also the practices of human life in a certain way? How do LARPers learn and develop from those practices of just like making your own stuff, or not being able to see everything that's going on, or like just, it's just a brilliant little space. And I love the ideas of that Dr. Sarah Lynn Bowman talk about within EduLARP. I love the development of EduLARP as an idea, as a methodology. And I look forward to being able to essentially use that kind of storytelling as a form of pedagogy for kids that I get to work with. And already I have gotten been able to do so early this summer, in fact.
So. Right. Yeah. So I wanted to have you on the show because I met you briefly at Living Games. I loved your keynote and I really loved your presentation at the EduLARP conference. It sounds like you're doing really, really interesting work. So you're like, just kind of correct me if I'm wrong, but you're doing these sort of like educational LARPs that are about nature and the environment and systems and learning to figure out your place in them and how they operate and that kind of thing. And it's specifically with like Indigenous kids in your area, right?
So I work with Dr. Megan Bang and the rest of my cohort, along with other organizations local to here that are Seattle urban Native organizations, including Red Eagle Soaring, United Indians for All Tribes Federation or Foundation, and then Nile He Fund, who also works with Indigenous communities and programs and their with their programming group called Native Girls Code. We together with other community members and things like that, with people who want to participate, and of course the kids, we run an Indigenous STEAM LARP, that whole, you know, making sure that art science is a part of the work. And the STEAM, did I say LARP? I meant STEAM camp. So that there's a whole week-long camp devoted to learning about land, waters, and community, and how we can understand gifts, relations, and roles that come that are inherently a part of our plant and beach and water and land relatives as Indigenous peoples. And so I've got working with all these outdoor educators and Dr. Bang and community members to teach about, like this year we talked mainly about, we talked a lot about beach relatives. We talked about the shiftings of tides. We talked about stories around rocks and how a rock came to be here and what kinds of rocks came to be here, and linking all of these together and essentially observing the micro ecosystems around various focal plants. And we do this around, of course, Indigenous local plants that have particular ties to the region and ties to stories that we wanted to talk about. And I got to develop this year the second iteration of the STEAM LARP. Last year, basically, I took a lot of the things that we were teaching about and scaffolded the kids through a lot of these embodiment exercises to get them into thinking from the perspectives of these plants. And I focused specifically on the plants because that's where we were at the time, and I wanted to just get into non-human embodiment and see where a lot of these kids would take it. And they were beautiful naturals at it. And not only that, they as I might have gotten to say in the presentation at LGC, that these kids are not just learning about these ecosystems, they're putting themselves in the perspectives of these ecosystems. My favorite excerpt from it, talking about it at the LGC, was about a kid who I had transformed into a young person. I transformed into a bear, going around and into all these groups of plants and eating, looking for stuff that they could eat. And this young person encounters a grouping of sword plants and starts eating away at all the sword plants, and goes to eat another young person. And this young person responds with, "No, you can't eat me. I'm actually a spore, and I attach myself to you." And so for me, like that that one moment shows me so many things of one, that they're not only playing with the creatures and relationships that plants have with one another, but also they were playing with time and perspective and cycles in ways that a lot of other forms of instruction or developed programs, I don't see getting to that kind of level of thinking where the grain size isn't just, you know, one plant at a time in one cycle, and then that's it. But these kids were going off like way off in different directions that I couldn't even predict. And this year it was even more of the same, but even bigger. So I got to run, this year's the finale for the camp was designed around the four seasons. And so I had them going through 20 minutes of scenes, or 15 minutes of scenes to get through four seasons. And then I also put in traditional trickster figures, as well as put in various people from stories. Like there's a story about in the Pacific Northwest about Wolf transforming Blackberry from this beating Blackberry, who had become unruly and huge and was lashing out at the community, was beaten down into the Wolf with this whalebone club, and the story goes is that the Blackberry was transformed from this giant, like tree-like figure down to these really low-lying bush, and ground growth that is slightly why our local blackberries have a slight white coloring to their stalks because of the powder that fell off of the whalebone club as the blackberry was beaten with it. And so I put Wolf into our scenario, into our space, and with a buffer, as in fact as a whalebone club, and so they got to go around as Wolf managing unruly groups of plants or animals who were living in the ecosystem out of balance, and watching how people were transforming their play and actions as I going around again this year as Moon the Transformer, transforming various plants and animals into other plants and animals, preparing the world for the people to come, as our cultural story goes. Being able to witness how change affected their play, and then not only that, how interacting with the figures of their own stories and their lores also enacted their play, where a lot of focus was given into that space, and how it brought out some of these kids wanting to interact with their and bring to the table their own cultural stories to the play in ways that I can't. I would be talking for hours if I would tell you all the stories of stuff that I saw. Mm. It was just such a beautiful space that I look forward to trying to, again, the next iteration, to do more of this and develop it more deeply. And really also to try to find a way at some point to turn this into a much larger LARP context where I can have more Indigenous kids and their families come into a space and be able to play with their own cultural icons and their stories and their ways of being and knowing in stuff that I haven't even thought about and planned yet. Like it's just on the tip of my tongue, and I'm still able to keep talking ad nauseum about this stuff, but like, it, for me, just seeing how these kids were transforming, were wanting to be, were coming to life, and how the ecosystems that they were learning about suddenly took on a new set of meaning for them, and the learning that went around with what the plants needs or what their roles and relationships with were with one another, it told told a story of what these kids were learning, as well as the perspectives of the plants that they were coming from. So like there were so many different layers of seeing. One, and did the learning get attached to the kids? Yes, great. And then two, how does this ecosystem live? What is this ecosystem like in comparison to what the, you know, real ecosystem looks like? And watching them do this was just, you can't write it. You just yeah. can't write this stuff. You can only just yeah. give them the roles and then boom. So it does so much more with learning in a way that lets these children build rule sets, emerge with these rule sets, and come to be and do so much with one another in ways that the papers don't exist. It hasn't been written yet. So like, yeah. I don't know how to talk about this stuff just nearly as intensely as was experiencing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And just based on what I've heard, you're really on the cutting edge of something. Like you're really on something that feels like genuinely new, and I feel genuinely unexplored for a lot of people. You know, I talk to people who love LARP and who study LARP and are role playing in general. And I think a lot of people are ready to accept or admit or acknowledge that role playing can be personally transformative, mm-hmm. and it can be therapeutic on kind of a personal level. But, you know, in your presentation, and I wrote this down in my notebook, you wrote that one of the objects of this like LARP camp that you're doing with the kids was to find out how we can live respectful, reciprocal, and responsible relationships with our land, water, and community. And to me, that is just such a gigantic, like, that's an incredible question that I feel like a lot of people are asking, and they genuinely have no idea how to even start answering that. I mean, do you feel like you're starting to come up with answers, or do you feel like LARP is the best way to interrogate that huge, huge question?
Well, the things that I find that are encountered more often than not within LARP communities, as I've gotten to encounter them so far, is that the community is the part that they're focusing on. And so within the perspective of from the STEAM camp that I've gotten to be a part of, it's our big question is about how do we live respectful, responsible, reciprocal relationships with lands, waters, and communities, right? It's the lands and waters part that become a really integral part, because for us in those spaces, we are looking at the local to understand our community, not from the global and universal. And a lot of people draw off of global and universal thinking in ways that don't help their own local cultures get mm-hmm. met where they are. And that's the thing. That's the thing that also that I've come to learn working with kids is it's not about bringing your point of view to them. It's about understanding their point of view and the, you know, there's a term, education term called funds of knowledge, that this basically this bank of stuff that people already come with. You know, nobody comes into an area as a blank friggin' slate. It just doesn't happen. I mean, it's arguable whether or not even babies are really blank slates as they come into a space, into the world, in fact. And there's a lot of thinking and politics that could go around that. But aside from that, the whole idea is that within a lot of these games, I know that we're, especially with the census, the LARP census ended up being like a really interesting, space that I'm hoping that more people will use to understand the local, less so the global ramifications of what LARP and regional LARP looks like, is like, acts like, because you know there are so many blogs and quips and Facebook chats that are all deeply about how one person's LARP is different or better than others in various ways, and it doesn't serve as nearly as a good purpose as one would like to think. Like it doesn't grow the community to sit there and talk about these things as being better than one another, but to be specific about what kinds of things that you do locally within your group, within your community, within your design that will help you come to understand what it is you're doing. Like, does anybody really reflect deeply on their own design? Like, how often do people shift these things. And I can't say does anybody, because I'm sure that everybody's reflecting on a lot of stuff in ways directly or informally, or even just reflexively doing reflection on things without even thinking about it. There's so much that can be learned about each individual local group, even before you talk about a national level something or other, like whether or not you're talking about Dystopia Rising or Alliance or Nero or all these other
franchises.
The franchise games, right? Mm-hmm. Whether or not the franchise at the top has an effect on the players at the middle or the bottom of these spaces in ways that's transformative. Like, are these organizations? How are these organizations teaching their players, and how can they teach their players towards a sense of understanding themselves as a group and a community, and how that's different from, or how that puts a flavor of LARP and play out there that's going to encourage everybody else from a local region or even a super regional space to come in and be involved in your game. You can't just be about a Nordic LARP as a term. It can't just always be that, because to even say Nordic LARP or US LARP or just even North American LARP, you're missing out on so much that's going on by putting everything in this box. This box that doesn't really say anything really dynamic or nuanced about the way people want to be playing.
Yeah, that's interesting. I often wonder how to have more specific conversations about LARP and different forms of LARP. And I, you know, like even words like freeform and words like boffer LARP, like boffer sounds specifics to some people when in fact it covers like so many games that are so different, have such different goals and different setups and different communities. Like, I really think that like every game is different and every community is different, and games will pretty much inevitably be shaped by the community that plays them and kind of plays to their needs. And like, I'm excited that all these different LARP communities are talking to each other, you know, like Living Games was amazing for that. But I hope that we don't become a monoculture. Like, I hope that we continue to be really, really regionally different. Tell me about the gaming community. I don't know how much you still do tabletop gaming, but I'm assuming you still do a lot of LARP stuff in the Pacific Northwest and around Seattle specifically. Like, what does that culture look like? What are the needs and the practices of your local gaming culture?
You know, I like to say that I have been playing a lot more of recent, but I've been entrenched in a lot of research and then my own exams for a few months now, and so I haven't really been playing since about, I keep thinking this is still the same year that I've stopped playing in. Cause so much has happened, but I think I stopped playing around March, not willfully. Mm-hmm. But there's just so much I need to get done. And also I kind of have, me and my partner kind of have a baby on the way. So I know that's,
that changes things.
It does. It'll stop me from playing some things. The community around here, I found to be so wonderful enough to be able to and unique about how they were playing things that I felt like I had to research it. And so a big chunk of my own research, I'm actually going to be submitting a piece of research that I did last year and formulated much more succinctly for the audience for Analog Game Studies soon. That was on a local boffer high fantasy game, and the way that people play is so much more immersive than I would have expected from what I hear about how the other chapters in that high fantasy franchise to be playing as, because I hear that on other coasts that it's kind of like D&D in the woods, and not to the extent that one would hope that it is about like role playing, but more so about rules, mechanics, and what they all seem to joke about as murder hobos finding treasure off of dead bodies.
Right.
And so there are players who do play like that, who do definitely still have a modicum of that focus, but I see them getting transformed by so many of these other players who are deeply tied to their characters. And I'm not talking just about characters who have been played for like almost two decades, but like characters who have been in development and been played for like only a couple of years, or brand new characters getting immersed into deep role play without having to have a huge power curve to affect these high fantasy battles or whatever. But that people seem to like around here, deep think, deep reflection around characters that are designed around their own personal stories, whether or not it's something that they're trying to deal with about traumas that come from their family or relationships, or they're trying to deal with the various kinds of isms that they face on a daily level, or they're trying to transform themselves from introverted practices to extroverted practices in ways that they've never found themselves being comfortable to doing so in their regular everyday life. The kinds of drama therapies that I see emerging from the Pacific Northwest are deeply meaningful and impactful to me. And I love it. I honestly love it that one story of one person's play in my research was being able to use the pain of their character to understand their partner's fibromyalgia, and to be able to put themselves in that state of figurative and imaginative and creative suffering in a way that helps them try to be a better partner for the person that they're with.
Right.
Right. That in and of itself is like, whoa, like yeah. There's people don't come up with programs that teach that. People don't yeah. In counseling and social work, that kind of drama therapy, that's
yeah.
Where does that come from? You can't find that emergent to anything other than the situation that it's coming from like that. And the Pacific Northwest is full of a hybridized space of combat and role play in ways that I hope will become as really key traits to what people around here like to play with. Mm-hmm. There's another game. There's a game out here called Spite that it was again developed by my best friend Ron Liotta and a number of other wonderful people, Matt Ostman and Carmen Swift, the Brian Johnson.
It's okay. You don't have to name them all.
No. There's some really great people who are doing some really fantastic work in storytelling on an event that is sold specifically to be not your primary LARP. And so weird, it only goes on twice a year. And so it's really interesting that the people who are super deep, intense LARPers, who are really, really deep in role play, bring all these great props, create these amazing characters, and they intermix with a bunch of people who are brand new to the idea of role play within these games, whether or not they happen to be amp guarders or like, humans versus zombie nerf players over in parks and things like that, coming together in a futuristic, in the middle of the war LARP about fighting these alien bugs that have come and destroyed a good chunk of humanity. And it has a very strong feel of like Starship Troopers, the LARP. But very, very much doesn't interact with just that kind of thinking in that space, has allowed so many of these new burgeoning young players or inexperienced players, to just see that the role play can affect people super intensely when they were just there to hit things with sticks or shoot things with Nerf darts, or dress up in really cool costumes and play doctor or whatever. The fact that people are able to use a very transparent and porous boundary between in-game and out-of-game, because it's set only like 30 some odd years in the future, that people are able to, some people have even opted to play themselves 30 years in the future, to go through that space. And they walk away. Like, I remember game one, people were walking away with these experiences of, how does this one player walked away going, how do I react to holding a child's bloody clothing for like within this game space. And what do I do with that? What does my character do with that? What do I as a character do with that? And they ended up like in deep reflection at the game for a good chunk of time, more time than they ever would have thought to sit and think at a role playing game as part of the play, rather than always be moving, always be acting, always be reacting, and watching people go into these spaces where doctors and counselors and teachers are a part of the ecosystem of players in game as well as out of game. And watching that transform how people take on interacting with one another and talking to each other in down times like not being attacked. What do you do in a war situation when you're not fighting at the time? How do you keep preparing? And not everybody in this game is attached to military or has military history. So they play with what what kinds of concepts they've seen in various media spaces. I can't inform, of course. I would love to do a survey on where do you get your science fiction and fantasy concepts from. Like, I want to see how badly or impressively a show like Battlestar Galactica or Babylon 5 deeply influenced their kinds of what do we do when we're not shooting guns moments. And how these deep stories of transformation and people dying at funerals and like just all these kinds of things that they've never had to interact with, just such powerful spaces that and you know, I'm just going to keep saying the word powerful over and over again because I don't have a really good other set of word, because it's just so, it's so deeply transformative for a lot of these players. And then they go, this is only twice a year. What do I do? How do I find more? Yeah. And then they find out that there's a whole world of play that they can get involved in. Like, playing in other people's games is so important. Like, I can never understand why anybody would either like hoard players or like, you know, why people would be angrily poaching players. Like, what's the deal is with those kinds of things?
Yeah, the idea of poaching players is super weird to me. Like, you know, we can all play together, right? Like, we're like, more play is better. People bring in more players, and if they love your game, it's probably going to make them want to play more other games, right?
And then they become better players.
Yeah, exactly. They bring more to the table when they have more and different experiences.
I've found for a lot of the work that I do that diversity is a super key to the development of community, and not just in the sense that of diversity of race or ethnicity, but diversity of thinking. And when so many people sit there and wrench on diversity as being super important, or our community is already really diverse and we don't need more, or whatever wacky things that I hear in various spaces, it's really wild to me, because like there shouldn't be a limit. Did you reach the boundary of how your game can grow and think and produce? No. So like, why not? Why wouldn't you want to include people who are combat focused in a game that's super heavy on role play? Because sometimes you want your players to move around more. And then those players who are so entrenched in playing to lose or playing to feel, why would you not want to include them on games where you're developing a hero's journey so that everybody in a community shares a win? Like, so there's so many different ways that all of our forms of play can, could, and would be essentially bleeding together in a space. And eventually, I hope, you know, somebody's going to have like LARP the meta LARP, you know, essentially, and create a space where we are bouncing between all of these different frames and layers of between players and how could we get into that kind of like deep thinking about the thinking space that helps us understand one another within these games in a more interesting and deep ways that I just keep wanting to play with for the rest of my life.
I know. And if there's one thing that I just keep learning over and over, it's that having like beautiful, existentially powerful, transformative experiences and hitting stuff with sticks are definitely not mutually exclusive.
Yeah, right.
Those two things can be very good friends.
And that's the thing is that like all forms of play, like I remember hearing at the LGC of just like, you know, that idea that it's nerds all the way down. So why is it embracing one another and embracing one another's forms of play isn't a part of our everyday practices? I'll never understand. But I will keep pushing on it. That's for sure.
That's amazing. We're just barreling through the show here, which is awesome. The last thing I want to ask you about, you had a keynote at Living Games on culturally responsible game design. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, in sort of short form, I mean, I can direct people to that keynote, but mm-hmm. what does that mean to you? What is culturally responsible game design?
So Klaus actually had a fantastic, like, short 2-minute interview with me.
That interview, yes. Yeah, I've seen that.
Like that, like, I don't know if I can put it more succinctly than I put it there, but like the whole idea around a culturally responsible game design is going to be a part of a bigger framework of thinking that I'm going to put out at some point, because I want it to be deep and I want it to be well thought out. But the short of holding responsibility towards one another in this space is, of course, to be specific about where you're coming from, to hold your standpoint, to reflect on it and to understand and then teach others about what it is that you know and how are you playing, how are you doing your game design, how are you doing your character design, all these kinds of thinking that you obviously have gone into great lengths, either thinking about your own life and your own family history or doing, you know, hours and hours of research that goes into a character. Well, why don't you want us to understand about it? Like, why do these things have to be, intuitively picked up on, or just like an aha moment where like we see somebody's character in a way that we don't necessarily earnestly and immediately pick up on, and the same with game design. So why not be specific? Because if we're specific about these things, that means that the players can choose whether or not they want to be involved with these things. And there's nothing wrong with choice, or there's nothing wrong with agency and in giving power to players to say, I'm going to have a powerful experience no matter what, but I want to choose which experiences I want to hold true to my heart and which experiences I want to go through and which ones that honestly, because of my life and because of the things that I've become involved with, I want to avoid because those are part of the things that I encounter on an everyday level. And so yeah. To be specific about your design and to be specific about your game and your community only helps draw in more people who think alike and draw in players who want to play within the same themes that you want to be. There's nothing there's nothing wrong with saying our game is about having fun, or this character, I play this character so I can be a jerk. There's nothing wrong with that, but there's everything wrong with not telling us that that's what you're doing with that, and not saying out what it is that isn't fun, or what it is that you're, as a character, you're willing to set aside so that other people can have fun being around your jerk character. Beyond being specific, there's encountering being wrong and being okay with being wrong. You're going to make mistakes. Because this is about human interactions. This is a very anthropocentric form of thinking about these games, is that, you know, getting to interact with one another is really, really the high point, the key of these social kinds of games. So having a sense of being wrong sometimes is painful, but it doesn't mean that you're a terrible person for having made a mistake. And while there are certainly a lot of buttons and boundaries that people can push on that will make somebody who has made a mistake feel aggrieved, like that they've done something so horribly wrong that they cannot be a part of, then it's also incumbent upon us within these communities to draw that person in, because it isn't just about them being wrong. It's also about us teaching and accepting that that somebody's going to make mistakes and come still want to be a part of this community or communities that you're a part of. So being specific, being wrong, are fantastic, but also let's be a little more critical about how we're doing these things. Like, just because somebody was wrong and just because somebody was specific about stuff in making references in their designs to a particular culture, were they doing it in a way that wasn't culturally appropriative? Were they doing it in a way that didn't remove power from a group of people or a community or a culture or ethnicity or a practice that doesn't, that elevates them, not reduces them down to just a thing that you want to play with or play in? And so don't just make references to something. Be critical about the work and the thinking in your design. So for me, be a critical thinker and be a critical designer. Don't just make references to something without thinking about why that's important to your design. Be specific about it. Talk about these things so that people can opt in and opt out of your stuff. And then be okay with being wrong, because your designs, while with the best of intentions, may still cause injury to somebody for various reasons. So you might as well be stepping into that space of, I'm not throwing out the baby with the bathwater, and yeah, I'm listening to what you're saying, and it hurts that I was wrong, and I'm going to do it better. How can I do this better? How can you help me do this better? Being open to that.
Right. And that's the nature of iterative design, mm-hmm. right? And all analog design has to be iterative, mm-hmm. because you need people in order to work it. You need to play test. And that requires people, meaning you have to run it, meaning you have to do it.
Right. It's not as if a teacher uses the same script every single day in and day out each year in order to convey content knowledge or particular pedagogies to kids or students or whatever. Pastors don't use the same sermons every single time. Mm-hmm. Why is it that one might hold themselves to particular designs and not be able to talk about these things in deep, meaningful ways that will help other people understand? Because in the end, you're just going to be telling a story about it. And if that story comes with a lesson of how to be or how to not be, it's not as if it won't. Every story is going to come with its own set of lessons that we're going to hear and we're going to pick up from learning about and hearing about these same stories over and over again. Because, I know I've told the same LARP war stories over and over again in multiple ways and multiple perspectives. And I know that for those people who are hearing me say the same stories over and over again, they're hearing something different, or they've checked out, of course, obviously I do ramble on quite a bit. I've got a lot to say, or I think I have a lot to say. And so there's a very, very real notion of saying these things over and over again is that your designs are going to come up against the wall of other people trying to learn something from it.
Right.
And it's going to teach something whether or not you want to teach.
I think that is totally key. Yeah. Be aware of what you're teaching, because you're teaching something. You're saying something. So think about what you're saying.
Right. Because having fun is one thing. What is the limit of having fun, and what is the boundary of what is not fun?
Yeah.
And then what is that teaching somebody when you're trying to create fun, not fun, as your categories to interact with? I don't know.
Well, Gabriel, it's been awesome having you on the show. If people want to keep up with your work or learn more about the projects that you're working on right now, is there a particular good way to do that?
Well, one of the groups that I am a part of and being involved with is NDN Players.
Right.
And we have a website for some of our work there called ndnplayers.com. So NDN, literally, just those three letters, NDN, mm-hmm. N as a native. ndnplayers.com will get you to a lot of the stuff that we're working on in terms of game designs. We're actually going to be producing a game on potlatch culture out here, and in Indian Players is to give the short quip is an indigenous intertribal, interdisciplinary, and intergenerational group that focuses on indigenous representation in geek and popular cultural spaces. And now we're branching into forms of game design and cultural consultancy, so that if people need help trying to figure out whether or not their design has flaws in terms of creating a culturally responsible game design, or has flaws in trying to get diverse players with diverse backgrounds and thinking into their communities and games, then we exist to help. We exist to help your product become stronger, your community become stronger, and inevitably for you as designers to become better designers. That's one space. People can find me on Facebook. I love talking to people. I've been a lot since Living Games Conference, getting to talk to various designers and become friends with and see their lives on everyday level. Heck, you know, I'm down for sharing all sorts of stuff. And you can just reach me at email. My email at the University of Washington is kender20, KENDER20 at uw.edu. And as a fifth year graduate student, eventually going to be a PhD, hopefully by the end of beginning of September, you can talk to me about my research on learning science and human development, which is actually my graduation will eventually call me a doctor around education psychology. And my focus will be on how we learn and how we develop. And my whole future is around the learning and development across life-wide and life-deep experiences. How do we learn across the life course? There's so much to be said about how play play research is done for kids. And yet, when we think about play in adults, it inevitably turns towards capitalism or ecosystems or communities in ways. But, there's still a lot of development and learning going on as adults.
Yeah, totally, totally. Oh, man, you're doing such interesting work. The NDN players sounds amazing. It'd be interesting to see what kind of who reaches out, you know, and who says, hey, I could really use a hand making my design a little more robust. And maybe you guys could let me know if I'm doing things right.
We've already had a few, in fact. Yeah. Galileo Games reached out to us for a game called How We Came to Be Here. And we're working closely with them on trying to turn that into a product that they're proud to have on the shelves. There was another couple of people who were working on an indigenous theme role-playing game that they haven't put out yet, but they wanted to consult with so that they didn't reach any weird faux pas. And just in general, being able to develop games in that way in space has actually made me want to teach a class on games adaptation within the College of Education as a way to create pedagogy so that teachers can look at how they can marshal game design as a way to teach material or to adapt material out. It was something that I picked up looking at Evan Torner's work at the LGC, seeing the adaptation of book material into a games format. Was like, why are we not giving that out as a pedagogy? What is this gamification crap? We don't need stickers and achievements. We need people to take games design as a part of a pedagogical move so that kids can see that they can create in various ways, and with various tools and in various, not just digitally, multimodal manners, but analogs. We can do creation of story. We can do creation of props. We can do all these things that LARP is so much of a great tool for so many people to learn from. I'm going to keep talking about these things forever.
I know. We could go on and on. Well, it was wonderful having you. Super, super interesting. And hopefully we'll be at the same con again sometime and we can just keep this conversation rolling.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks again to Gabriel for coming on the show. And as always, thank you for listening. Remember that if you have thoughts on today's show or you want to ask a question or leave a comment, you can always reach me via email at backstorypodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Google+, that's Backstory Podcast, or on Twitter at BackstoryCast. Backstory is part of the One Shot Podcast Network. You can find more great shows like One Shot, Campaign, Modifier, Talking Tabletop, First Watch, and Second Watch, all at oneshotpodcast.com. Music for Backstory is provided by Ujiko. The track is called Thinking of You, and you can hear more if you'd like at soundcloud.com/Ujiko. Talk to you later, heroes.